Right. This is Carson Backus interviewing Andrea Mowry on May 21st, 2024 for the Minnesota Historical Society Tobacco Control Oral History Project. We are meeting today at Andrea's office located in Eagan, Minnesota. Andrea, thank you again so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, perfect. We'll start with just an easy question. Could you just state and spell your full name, please?
Sure. Andrea Mowry. A-N-D-R-E-A M-O-W-E-R-Y.
Perfect, thank you. And I'd love to start out just talking a little bit about your earlier life. Could you just tell me when and where you were born?
Sure, I was born in Kalispell, Montana, where my dad was stationed in the Air Force.
Okay.
But I grew up from 1 year old, you know, on in Fargo, North Dakota.
Very cool. And can you tell me a little bit about your family then?
Sure. I have one sister, parents, a couple pets. We lived on, I guess I don't even know what the neighborhood is called, but the north side of Fargo in kind of a working class, lower middle class, maybe middle class neighborhood. And I was involved in sports in high school and earlier, I guess, and had grandparents that lived close by, and that is where the bulk of my vacations were, at their lake places in the Detroit Lakes area.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Perfect. And then can you tell me a little bit just about your childhood then as well?
Yeah, you know, I think a pretty normal Fargo, North Dakota childhood, to be honest. You know, again, grandparents that lived close by.
Mm-hmm.
One sister, you know, I enjoyed school and sports and did a little bit of a few other types of activities, academic clubs and things like that. But, you know, both my parents were with me all the way through high school. And then my dad was activated in the military in college for a Desert Storm. But, and I came to Hamline University for college.
Okay.
And so that's what kind of uprooted me, and I never went back, I guess,
okay.
Except for breaks. And then I've stayed here ever since in the Twin Cities area.
Okay, very cool. And what brought you to Hamline?
You know, I really was attracted to the Twin Cities because it was kind of the next biggest place, and it was far enough away.
Sure.
But still close enough to drive to. I also ran track and cross country there, and so the coach invited me to be on the team, and I really appreciated that, and I had a fantastic experience at Hamline.
That's great. And I'm interested too, you're talking about how your childhood revolves a lot around sports, kind of segueing into my next question then about how smoking impacted your life while growing up. Was that something that you the athletic and the smoking aspects combined with that. Were you a smoker as a teenager or anything like that? Or were you around a lot of secondhand smoke?
You know, I wasn't really. I mean, especially when I think about the time period it was, the 70s and 80s
sure.
is when I grew up. And, you know, I knew that my mom had smoked as a young person, but not after I was born. You know, grandmas did. I had one grandma that smoked occasionally growing up. And it was interesting because I would often bug her about it.
Okay.
But I also thought it was a little bit glamorous because she was so glamorous. She owned a department store and then a women's clothing store after she retired from the department store. And was a business owner and a really successful woman, and along with my grandpa. But she quit by the time I was in high school. And I have to say that, I mean, I grew up, it was that time period where I think more and more was being communicated about that smoking's bad for you.
Okay.
I never really considered it. I was annoyed that it was still kind of okay. Like, I don't know that we would have at my house, but like my grandma, if someone asked if they could smoke, she would say yes, you know, because she thought it was polite. And you'd go into bars and restaurants. Well, I didn't go to bars that much then, but you know, bar, restaurant, restaurants. And, you know, there would be smoke because there was no, you know, it was, I mean, if they had a smoking section, it was just open to everything anyway. So, but, you know, my friends group, everyone was athletic, and I'm sure that people might have done some or tried it, but really that was not a big theme, to be honest. I mean, I knew people that smoked in school, but it just wasn't a part of my life.
Okay.
So, looking back, I obviously appreciate that a lot.
That makes sense. I guess the second part of this question then, did this motivate at all your work in the field later on? It sounds like maybe not, if it wasn't a huge part of your childhood.
To be honest, not really. Okay. I think that what motivated me in the work, and we might touch on this in mm-hmm. a little bit, I think two things. You know, my mother-in-law, who passed away about 12 years ago, mm-hmm. really struggled with tobacco addiction, as far as I know, since she was a teenager, but certainly in all the time I knew her. And I think that really, as it kind of, as I was an adult and was getting to know her and then knew her for a good number of years, it just became so obvious to me how addictive it is. And I developed a lot of empathy for people who did smoke, because most want to quit and it's extraordinarily difficult. It really clicked for me too that the tobacco industry has to get people to start when they're teenagers or really young adults. Otherwise, they would have no customers, right? That made an impression on me for sure. I think the other thing that did, when, you know, my first job out of college was at the Attorney General's office, mm-hmm. and I worked in policy and communications there. And during the time I was there, you know, Skip and the office, and then with their partner, Blue Cross Blue Shield, filed the lawsuit that became the historic lawsuit. Mm-hmm. I think that, although I didn't work on that, it really did allow me a view to that, how the tobacco industry worked, how, again, they had to addict people very young in order to stay in business, mm-hmm. how they got to make billions and billions of dollars while everyone else paid, you know, billions in healthcare costs, you know, through taxpayers and taking care of people who had tobacco-related diseases. And to be honest, the fiscal responsibility and the kind of the unfairness of that fiscal equation really struck me at the time. So I think those were two, you know, as I then later came to have this opportunity to work there, those things were in the background for me for sure, motivating me.
Okay, very cool. And did that continue while you were in college? Was there also, were you also kind of separated from the smoking community in college as well?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I mean, I think being a track and cross-country yes. runner, especially a long-distance runner, there's not a lot of room or space for smoking. And I don't recall really anyone else, you know, on the team smoking, to be perfectly honest. Not saying they didn't, but I don't recall that at all. Mm. And, you know, I think at that time, too, you know, late 80s, early 90s, there was becoming more, I'd say just more attention a little bit, even in college, a little bit around people who would smoke at parties and people who didn't want them to smoke, because it was so, like, it went everywhere, right? Different than drinking, where you could hold your own cup and nobody else had to drink it. Mm-hmm. So I think that, again, not that it didn't ever happen, obviously, but I think that that was kind of intersecting around that time period as well. So,
okay, interesting. And was that tension, do you think that was brought from kind of the raising awareness about the harm of tobacco? Are there other reasons that people didn't like, they just didn't like the smell of smoke?
Or? I think there was a lot of you didn't really like the smell of
it. Okay.
I mean, I think people knew it was bad for you. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was any secret by that point.
Okay.
I guess I'm not that old, but definitely no secret by that point. But I think it was more, that's really annoying. And people would go out to bars and then talk about how they just have to undress before they even walked into, you know, their house, because it was just so pervasive and you just felt icky. And the next day, whether you had had a drink or not, you might feel hungover just from the secondhand smoke. So I think some people were just annoyed by it. And yeah. So okay. Less about I mean, if you want to do that to yourself, go ahead, but don't do it around me because it stinks and you're going to make me smell.
Exactly. But that makes sense.
Yeah.
So this question is kind of related to that then, and you've touched on this a little bit, but how aware were you of general efforts to reduce the use of tobacco products while you were growing up?
You know, I mean, I remember, I mean, my parents as well as at school, I just always knew, well, these are bad for you. You don't want to do it. People should quit. And, you know, and that more people were quitting. I think that, you know, was something that was really, you know, the Surgeon General's report came out in the 60s. And so by the 70s, people were taking notice for sure. So, so it wasn't, I don't remember it being, you know, overarching, but I remember it just being a norm. Like, we don't smoke at our house, you know, we don't want you to around smoke, that kind of thing.
Okay. And were you taught any of this in school? Like, did people come in and tell you about the harms of smoking?
You know, my guess is at some point, but I can't remember any time. Okay. You know, my, you know, health is what it was called then. I'm sure they covered it and maybe even brought in people, but I don't really remember.
Okay. Cool. Transitioning a little bit then to talk more about your career, I'm curious to hear about your career pathway and how it eventually led to you joining Clearway.
Yeah. So as I mentioned to you, my first job out of college was at the Attorney General's office in the Policy and Communications Division. And that is, you know, again, the lawsuit was filed while I was there. I kind of had a front row seat in some ways to seeing it, even though I didn't work on it. And I really enjoyed my time there. I was really proud to be associated with that office. Skip Humphrey is not only just a wonderful man, but I think he really tried to improve life for Minnesotans in so many ways, this being one of the main ones, but other ways as well. Yeah, he's just a really kind, nice man who used that office fairly expansively to you know, do some things to improve life in Minnesota. From after I was at the Attorney General's office, I went to a public relations and marketing firm. Again, I had worked in policy and communications already for over 5 years at the AG's office. And then I went to Thunheim Partners and had a great experience there. Kathy Thunheim was and still is the principal or the president there. And
could you spell that for me?
Thunheim?
Yeah.
T-U-N-H-E-I-M.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's a great firm. And, you know, at that time, they, if I recall this right, they had been, you know, more corporate PR and marketing, had great clients like Target you know, Target Corporation and others. You know, Honeywell, back when there was a Honeywell and some others. But when I got there, I wanted to get some of that experience, but they also wanted to build a public affairs practice. So I worked on that as well and had a great time doing that and just got some great experience and did a lot of, you know, traditional public relations and marketing, but also a lot of crisis management and public affairs work. And so while I was there, a former colleague of mine called, and he had been, so, you know, by that time, the tobacco settlement had occurred a few years before, and Clearway, Minnesota had been established, but it was, you know, only a couple of years old. And he said, you know, they're looking for a director of communications, and I think you have, you know, the right set of skills. And it's a small organization, so you have to have kind of a broad set of skills, not be so specialized, and I did. And so I talked to him a little bit, and I thought, well, this could be really interesting, a really interesting way to kind of apply my talents in a really focused way, but one for good, and I'm using air quotes, you know, like, you know, that felt good as well, but that was interesting. And so after... But I also knew that the issue of tobacco reduction and prevention could be, there could be disagreements about how to do it, right, and how to get there. But despite that, after, you know, they offered me the job, I accepted it and I moved forward with it.
Very cool. And what year was that?
2002.
2002, perfect, yeah. Okay.
I think.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Close enough. Okay, perfect. No, that's great. Could you talk a little bit about the nature of Clearway's mission and what personally resonated with you about the mission?
Sure. I wanted to make sure that I got the mission right.
Oh, perfect.
So I had it down here. Right, so the mission was to enhance life for all Minnesotans by reducing tobacco use and exposure to secondhand smoke through research, action, and collaboration. And, you know, I love that mission, right? So take what is arguably one of the biggest public health issues and let's see if we can reduce it by a lot, right? I think there were really three things that attracted me to Clearway, Minnesota. First was that idea of I might be a part of changing the arc of tobacco use and secondhand smoke exposure in Minnesota, because at that time, although there was a Clean Indoor Air Act, which was passed by people that were, you know, far ahead of the game in the 70s, you know, you could still smoke in bars and restaurants and other workplaces. So just a different time than today. But that was really, you know, I think to change something kind of collectively around a public health issue that's a big issue was exciting and it felt meaningful. I think the second reason was that Clearway, Minnesota was so unique. Mm-hmm. So it was an independent foundation. And it was really conceived out of the Koop-Kessler report, Surgeon Generals Koop and Kessler, that wrote a report kind of as all the states, various states, were filing suit against the tobacco industries and then coming to settlements. And in this report, you know, they said, you're going to get a lot of money, states. You should be smart with that money and not just absorb it into your general fund. Mm-hmm. You should set up an independent foundation so you can't take it. That will work on this issue. And nobody else but Minnesota did that, which was really interesting and unique. And I thought that was pretty cool. And the reason why it's so cool is because independent foundations or nonprofits can lobby. And policy change is just, like, so important to reducing tobacco use and preventing tobacco use. So the third reason was that it was life-limited. And that was really an interesting concept to me. I didn't even realize at the time how much I would enjoy the urgency of that. Like, although I was there for 15, 16 years, mm-hmm. it goes by fast. It's a big issue to solve. Mm-hmm. It's not enough time to solve that whole issue, right? But you can make a lot of progress. And by having this life-limited structure, you know, we stayed so focused and disciplined on what we were trying to do. And I loved that atmosphere, that environment. So that's kind of what brought me to it.
Wonderful. That's just so interesting that you say that that's a pro. I could see a lot of people picturing that as a con, that it's a life-limited organization, just because you don't have enough time to do everything that you want to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know, it's just, it's nice that you have a different perspective of
yeah.
it.
And well, I don't know how the organization would have gone had it been an in-perpetuity type mm-hmm. organization. I think its budgets would have been a lot smaller.
Fair enough.
It might have had to fundraise, which is a whole different ballgame. We didn't have a development department, you know, nothing like that, because it was like, here's the endowment, you spend it in 25 years or less, and you do all the good you can, you create as much change as you can in the time you have with the resources you have. So very focused, and that was really a guiding light for us. Every time we did strategic planning, we asked ourselves at every stage of the organization, what is the most impact we can have with the time and resources we have? What should we be focused on? There you go.
So interesting. And then I'm curious too, so you said that Minnesota was the only state to make use of these funds. What reasons do other states have to not or create an organization out of these funds?
Well, I think legislatures don't like to do that.
Okay.
Government doesn't like to do that, right? And I'll give you an example that I think is true here and true in all states. Mm-hmm. You know, when the settlement happened in Minnesota, this chunk went to Clearway, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. This chunk went to Blue Cross Blue Shield because they were part of, you know, the in partnership with the Attorney General filing the suit. A chunk went to the state of Minnesota mm-hmm. specifically for youth prevention. Mm-hmm. And then a chunk went into the general fund. And there were payments into perpetuity that still go on today, that go into the general fund. So during one of the years, during budget deficit, and you know, every state goes up and down with that, I am not going to be able to call out the year. It might have been around 2008-ish, or I don't recall now. I'm sorry that I don't remember. But the legislature and the governor decided to take back that endowment from Department of Health and use it to plug the deficit. And so a lot of states have done that since. So if you create a foundation like the one that was created to form Clearway, Minnesota, states can't do that, right? It's out the door already. It's not theirs anymore. It's sitting over here. And so I think that states, and I can see in some ways why, they're very hesitant. And in fact, that's why I don't know if there are any other examples on any other topic where that has happened. I do think it's a very brave and... Because when you think about the $6.2 billion settlement and then payments into perpetuity, and you know, for as long as those companies sell tobacco products here in Minnesota, which they still are, you know, Clearway Minnesota got $202 million. So it wasn't that much, but we did a lot with it. But, you know, I don't think states get those kind of settlements every day either, but I think it's really worth, you know, a look. The state, you know... you know, just settled with Juul recently, and as far as I know, there's no independent foundation coming out of that. Okay. There'll be money that goes to the health department, I think, based on that. So, you know, and based on legislation that was passed. Okay. But that's, I'm getting out of my lane because that's really recent, but
it's okay.
I just think it's control and needing the money depending on what you think the priorities are.
That makes sense. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Can you describe a little bit about what Clearway was like when you first came on board?
Yeah. Let's see. It was small.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of enthusiasm. So I think there were about maybe 10-ish people when I came on board.
Wow, that is small.
Yeah, and we didn't get huge. Sure. You know, there were 30 people, mm-hmm. Maybe at the height of it. You know, we wanted to be really careful about, you know, not expanding to such a big staff. We used contractors a lot of the time, agencies, okay. things like that. But it was still very young, though, right? It had only been operating for 2-ish years, and it was trying to still establish its culture, policies, staffing, its focus. So it created a lot of opportunity to shape things in those early days.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And I imagine it was pretty collaborative at that point, maybe throughout its existence, but you were working in different, you had your hands in like different fields, I imagine, and working with lots of different people.
Yeah, I think it got even better at being collaborative as
really?
A group,
okay.
for sure, for sure.
Okay.
I think it just takes a little while for teams to form and for a culture to be formed and for those, that trust to develop, to be really collaborative.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think we got really good at it. But, you know, I think it was there in the beginning, but, you know, everyone's new. So I don't think there's much of a foundation yet.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. And then I know this very big thing happened at Clearway, the mm-hmm. Attorney General Office's lawsuit against
yeah.
Clearway. Can you explain how that impacted your early days working with Clearway?
Yeah. It impacted it in every way.
Yes.
Like, there wasn't a way that it didn't impact it, right?
Absolutely.
So I had been there 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
When that lawsuit was filed.
Gracious.
And although I knew, as I mentioned to you before, I knew there could be controversy or disagreement about mm-hmm. How to go about tobacco reduction and prevention,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I had envisioned that. But nonetheless, it happened, and, you know, I mean, it challenged the organization's existence, right? The part of that lawsuit, as it progressed, was about stripping us of the endowment that created us, and without money, you can't do that work. So my job quickly turned from developing media campaigns and public, kind of like what you'd think of as normal public relations mm-hmm. and, you know, and some advocacy work to crisis management and working with the legal team. to develop strategies to survive so that we could continue the important work that would fulfill Clearway Minnesota's mission eventually. I think the lawsuit also, though, accelerated how the organization matured. It, you know, one of the tenets of the lawsuit was that the board wasn't comprised of the right types of people, and that I shouldn't say it that way. Maybe I should say it as that some would have conflicts because they might be involved in the organizations that might receive funds because they were expert organizations in tobacco work, right? And so, or tobacco control and prevention work, I should say. So, you know, we went about really changing the organization's board makeup and governance dramatically and proposing that to the court. You know, the challenge of this really helped. I think that when you have that big of a crisis and that much stress and that much challenge, I guess, you know, organizations, people in them can turn on each other or they can come together. And I do think we came together. Board leadership, I mean, especially at a time where they were being challenged for their very, you know, as individuals for being on the board, they, you know, so many of them put the issue and the organization first and said, yep, let's, you know, let's try to look at other options. And the staff really came together to say, okay, how do we move through this together? None of us are going to be doing the jobs we thought we would be doing for the foreseeable future. So how do we move through this together? And so I think, you know, I think that the staff gained a lot of discipline and focus. And in the end, the challenge helped the organization really become more professional and strategic and humble and collaborative. And, you know, the end result of that lawsuit is that the science really prevailed. The judge ruled in our favor, you know, so that was good. And we were able to effectively move forward. But, you know, a key part of that decision in the ruling was that Clearway Minnesota could also do policy work. We could lobby, just like any other nonprofit can lobby. And that was huge because without that, we would not have made as much progress in reducing tobacco's harm. So, you know, I think that it, again, it challenged us in every way possible. You know, very, very stressful, really hard, but it also helped us mature and focus and, you know, really reflect. And, you know, and in the end, the judge, the plans we submitted to the court and the, you know, the judge did rule in our favor, which was great, right? You know, it took a long time and it took a lot of effort. And then it took, you know, it took a lot to come back from it, too. But it did bring us together, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. And I apologize. Could you maybe backtrack a step? I realize if you could provide a little bit of context into the lawsuit as well, maybe just the main reasons it existed.
Yeah.
Just for our listeners.
No, that's good. I think there were two reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, it's been a long time since I've read those documents.
Yes.
But the two that really stick out in my mind were... there were a series of articles that the Star Tribune ran about the organization in its first, you know, year or two before I got there. I knew that they had been published, you know, I came on shortly after they had been published, that really questioned if the organization was up and running yet, was it spending money the way it should, who was on the board, was the board conflicted, because there was a board member from Mayo Clinic and the Mayo Clinic got money, was that a conflict, or that there were, you know, several like that, right? You know, and so I think one of the things was the Attorney General saying, I'm going to, you know, investigate if this organization is using its funds correctly and if its board is conflicted. And then because the board had authorized policy grants and to work on policy, the Attorney General also, you know, said that was public money that formed your organization, you can't use public money to lobby. And so it was really kind of that, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more technical pieces on the legal side, mm-hmm. but those are what I recall as really the big sticking points, that we were going to lobby and work on policy, that the board might have conflicts of interest, mm-hmm. and those were really the two regarding the lawsuit. I think in the articles there was some sure. measure of are you getting the money out where you should. You know, I think it's interesting to me, and I've seen this play out with lots of organizations, when an organization gets a big chunk of money and they're supposed to do something with mm-hmm. it, it takes a little bit to develop the infrastructure sure. and policies and practices to make sure you're compliant with state and federal laws and doing your job and have good controls. And so I don't really recall that was a big issue, but for some reason in those articles, I believe that came up as well, that, you know, are they getting the money out in a timely fashion? I don't think that's what, you know, I don't recall that was what the lawsuit with the AG was about. That was more on okay. conflict and lobbying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm curious, too, so you mentioned these Star Tribune articles. To what extent was Clearway kind of in the public eye in its very early days, would you say? Like, I mean, would the general person off the street know about Clearway, or was it more of a specialized?
Boy, I think that the settlement, when the lawsuit with the tobacco industry mm-hmm. and the state settled, that was enormous news. I mean, it was international news, mm-hmm. right? And partly because Skip and Cerisi and colleagues, mm-hmm. You know, had approached it differently, mm-hmm. and took it to trial, quite frankly. But so really big news then, you know. I think the initial idea, and this is I'm kind of telling you as a spectator at the mm-hmm. time, because I wasn't, you know, I was at the AG's office when it settled,
sure.
but so of course I knew about it. But you know, I think that. At the time, there was a lot of talk about how the settlement money would go toward preventing and reducing tobacco use. I guess I can't really say, but I don't recall after that that, like, I knew there would be a nonprofit organization or a foundation started, and then money would go to the state, and Blue Cross got their money. I would be surprised if just a regular person might mm-hmm. know that until, you know... You know, or they might have read it in one of those initial articles, but then, you know. And keep in mind, this was before social media, too.
Yes.
So that made for kind of a different atmosphere on the how news spreads around side.
Yeah, of course. And then also, so you mentioned you had to develop strategies to survive during the lawsuit, and then you mentioned kind of restructuring the board. Were there any other strategies that you put in place to... Yeah, and sure, Clearway's continuing existence.
Well, you know, I mean, everything was going into the legal side for the most part.
Sure.
I mean, that's where we were going to prevail or not prevail, right? I think that there was a lot I did demand. I mean, we had a lot of media inquiries for probably, you know, I can't say, I mean, it ebbed and flowed, but for a good year, it was like nothing I had ever experienced before, to be honest. And, you know, we had varying... groups that were covering us. Some were more balanced than others, but, you know, it was what it was. With any kind of crisis like that, there's a cycle, I think, where, you know, someone disagrees with what you're doing. If they have the power to, you know, file suit, like in this case they do, you know, the media reports on it extensively, then other organizations might pile on, you know, because they see that they might gain from it or whatever. So there was a lot of, I mean, I spent a lot of my time working with the legal team on responses. I spent a lot of time fielding press calls and figuring out responses to those. I spent a lot of time writing strategic plans and plans that would respond to the court and helping work on those, and so did many people. You know, we also, though, through it, started really seeding, believing that we would come out on the other side. And then seeding that we, our reputation was really in a tough spot. Mm-hmm. You know, even for those that, you know, might be supportive of what we were trying to do, sure. when you're getting sued by the Attorney General's office, it's pretty rough. Yes. And so people were kind of backing away slowly.
Okay.
And so we started to, at that time, we also started, though, just to reach out and be transparent mm-hmm. about who we are, what we do, try to, if not rebuild relationships. Because remember, the organization was so young when this lawsuit hit.
Exactly.
I mean, it had barely gotten started on developing relationships with stakeholders,
sure.
you know, all across the state. You know, in every corner of the state, we had hoped. And so we did, you know, in the midst of all this, we did really try to, I kind of set about a program, and I remember me and a couple board members started it, and then we kept doing it through my entire time there, where we would do what we call community visits. And we would, you know, drive wherever we were going to drive, and try to visit 3 or 4 or 5 communities and visit with their media and visit with their mayor and visit with their health department and
wow.
anyone else who would give us a meeting.
Okay.
And just let them ask questions about what we were doing and who we are and how we, you know, how we were approaching reducing tobacco's harm and
okay.
preventing it, you know. And I think seeding that even while we were in the midst of that crisis mm-hmm. helped us, you know, move through that piece. Eventually, more people will take your calls, and that's a good thing.
Yes.
yeah, and so I think that helped, too. I mean, that was
Absolutely.
One of many, many things we tried to do. But, I think we really tried to be responsive to the concerns, the
okay.
concerns that had been raised.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that really, besides following the science and best practices and showing those to the judge who oversaw this case, we really tried to listen and reflect mm. and be responsive. So we hoped move forward to serve Minnesota and the people in Minnesota really, really well.
Wow. It's a hefty task. what were some examples of the communities that you visited? Was it just like local towns and
everywhere?
yeah.
I don't know. We have some good stories from those days. You know, I mean, Duluth, Thief River Falls, mm-hmm. Grand Forks, any small town around those.
Wow.
So sometimes we would pick a little bit larger city and then also, you know, visit any community around there that maybe had its own health department or had its own paper or had its own radio station
okay.
or... You know, again, keep in mind, before social media, when we were doing this, so, you know, and I just think that being able to let people ask us questions was so important. Like,
mm-hmm.
here we are in person. You've heard about us in the media. What would you like to ask us? Can we tell you about ourselves? You know, can we tell you about the organization and what we're trying to do? Can you, you know, would you ever think about working with us? You know, that kind of thing. And, so kind of anywhere and everywhere, a community visit would we try to, if they had a healthcare organization or a hospital or a clinic, try to visit with them, too, find out what was on their minds. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time on the road during that period.
Oh, for sure.
I think, too, that, you know, we were based in the Twin Cities,
yep.
and... You know, but we served all of Minnesota, and we wanted to make that very, very clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so making sure we traveled to all parts of Minnesota was really important.
That makes sense. Did you receive any resistance at all? Was it generally pretty positive interactions you had?
You know, I think we got tough questions. I think sometime, you know, yeah, I mean, we got tough questions
mm-hmm.
about what we're doing and what we think and what about this or what about that. And I think some people were pretty cool to us because, you know, remember, it's at a time where not everyone thought there should be clean indoor air in all workplaces. You know, it was at a time where, you know, even though a lot had been done on smoking, you know, there was, you know, I mean, much like we see today, I mean, there's a, well, don't get too far into my business,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't try to control what I can do. So, you know, some communities or some reporters, some mayors, you know, they would be very warm to targeting youth or like youth prevention or providing people with services to help them quit. Mm-hmm. But when it came to policy work, they would feel more uncomfortable with that because, you know, maybe their view was, well, how do we know that works? Although there was decades of research to show at the time it did. But they also just thought, boy, I need to think about that. Sure. That might be infringing on people's rights.
Interesting. Okay.
So,
Was smoking more prevalent in outstate Minnesota than it was in the Twin
yeah.
Cities? Okay.
Yeah. And it is still today.
Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
As far as I know. I haven't looked at the rates in like a year.
Okay.
As far as I know. I should put a caveat on that, but yeah.
Sounds good. All right. Perfect. Moving on then, did you have anything else you wanted to mention about this very big lawsuit? There we
go. I don't think so. I think we covered most of what I had down here.
Okay. It's so interesting. It really is. That, again, this happened 2 weeks after you began.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. All right. Perfect. So you wore many hats, obviously, while you were at Clearway. In what ways did your responsibilities overlap, and how did you collaborate with other departments?
Yeah. So there were, especially in the early days, it was probably more hats even, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, as we already touched on, even while the lawsuit was ongoing, you know, I felt like I had the charge to, you know, try to protect the organization's reputation mm-hmm. as much as possible at that point, and also build it, because you know we knew the work ahead of us that we wanted to do, and it would be really hard to do that without collaboration and partnerships.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, you know. Really tried to, you know, meet with stakeholders, develop partnerships, visit communities, be transparent, talk about how we were approaching this and what was to come. So we did a lot of that. And, you know, in the end, you know, if you fast forward 16 years down the road, I mean, I'm super happy to report, I think we were very well respected mm-hmm. in Minnesota and nationally. And I think because we brought forward those same principles, and maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Sure.
But when I think about kind of collaboration, I think it's an organization that, you know, here you have, it's a fairly small organization, but it's charged with doing some really big things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a cessation department because you need kind of that clinical expertise, right? You have a research department because we're a science-based organization and we want to evaluate everything we do besides the fact that we want everything we do grounded in science and best practice. And then you have a policy and communications group, right? And then you have, we had people that really focused on community outreach and community development and communities that had been very, you know, disproportionately harmed by tobacco, mm-hmm. although I will say that we all incorporated that into our work.
Okay.
Yeah, that was really, at the very beginning, a foundational principle at Clearway, mm-hmm. and we wanted to make sure that moved forward. So when you do all these things, you know, my team couldn't, you know, put together an advertising campaign to get people to quit plan services and help them quit without working with the cessation department. Without, you know, we couldn't look at, well, how do we change public opinion about secondhand smoke? How do we change what people should think of as the norm on mm-hmm. exposure without, you know, working with our research department and looking even nationally at the research and them helping us interpret that and mm-hmm. how do you then create a campaign around that, right? So there was, you know, how do we, any policy that we wanted to pass, any campaign we wanted to do, we also wanted to look at how would it impact communities that aren't always well represented,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm not saying we did that perfectly all the time, mm-hmm. but that was always a lens that we looked through and wanted to look through, and that was really important work. So I think that there was a lot of internal collaboration as the organization grew, you know, as I mentioned, to maybe, I think, around 30 people in the end, or not in the end, probably in the middle. But then we knew that collaboration was super important externally.
Sure.
That was very much a driving factor as well. So working with Blue Cross Blue Shield or the health department or American Cancer Lung Heart Association, the Association for Non-Smokers' Rights, you know, anyone and anyone who wanted to work with us, we wanted to work with them,
yes.
Right? And we also gave grants to a lot of different organizations.
Okay.
So that was in the mix as well.
Sure.
And then, you know, probably the other role that I played, and it became more pronounced in, you know, maybe the last 7 years versus the first, you know, 8 years, was that it was I led our strategic planning.
Okay.
And, you know, this kind of brings us back to the beginning of our conversation. Mm-hmm. So the board of directors at Clearway would pass the strategic plan. That was one of their jobs. So I'd work with them closely on it. But the staff recommended a strategic plan. And you know, with each strategic plan that we did, there was a finer point to be put on, you know, that question of what can we do, how can we have the most impact with the time and resources we have, had to be posed every time, and it had to be backed up by science.
Yes.
Every time. And then, you know, you have to weigh in the resources side of it. You know, we had a lot of money, but we didn't have infinite amounts of money.
Sure.
And we didn't want to duplicate what others were doing. So if Department of Health were, you know, especially in the early days, they were doing youth campaigns. We weren't going to do youth campaigns. And in fact, we never really did, you know. So that was, the strategic planning part was, became more and more interesting because we were life limited.
Absolutely.
You know, and how do we, you know, how do we keep answering that question and adjusting and moving forward? So I think too that, you know, when I think about collaboration and wearing all these hats and how I, you know, how we built our team, you know, at the end of the day, our leadership team, there was like four of us at the organization that comprised that for the time I was there, and the board were really, and the rest of the staff, so mission focused, but also really focused on excellence, and that this resource, this endowment that we were granted was just precious, right? Like no one else had done it in the country. We have to make unbelievable use of it. And so being very driven around creating results, creating outcomes, achieving goals and outcomes was really important, but at the same time that it was okay to make mistakes. That sometimes we were gonna try things and they weren't gonna work, but we were an organization that was nimble enough and didn't have too many layers that we could then adapt and change. And I think that was an incredible gift. And I still feel so grateful to have been a part of that leadership team and that structure, and a part of an entire team, all staff included, that were really committed to that and took advantage, I guess, of the circumstances we had.
That makes sense. Could you remind me who was on the leadership team?
Yeah, David Willoughby, who was the CEO, Barbara Shillow, who was oversaw research and cessation, myself, and then Paul Orman was the CFO. He left, I don't recall what year, and then Steve Bader was hired as the new CFO.
And how much... Like, how much turnover was there then in those life-limited years? It doesn't seem like a ton,
no,
but maybe a little
not
bit.
Not much.
Okay.
You know, I guess, you know, I mean, there were a handful of people that left Clearway, Minnesota in the time I was there for all kinds of reasons, right? But very few. I think in the time that I was there, I had two people that left my team.
Wow.
You know, and yeah, I think that's right. I might be wrong on that, but Not many. I mean, it was a really, I mean, the entire time I was there, Barbara Shillow and David Willoughby were there, and then just two CFOs, you know. I guess we had, toward the end, I think they, yeah, maybe Steve was done early too, but yeah, they're just, a lot of people had long tenures, of 10 years or more there, and I think it was because it was a really interesting and fun and challenging mm-hmm. place, but people really liked each other too, so that helps a lot. So that's good.
That's great. That feels so rare, maybe just nowadays, but it's nice that you're able to kind of maintain that sense of community.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's interesting. David, once in a while, sends something out, you know, once every year or two, I guess. Mm-hmm. Saying, hey, should we all meet at wherever? I know my former team, you know, we try to get together a couple times a year to have lunch. I still work with a couple mm-hmm. of them just on various projects.
Sure.
And it's fun, you know, and they're really talented people, great people.
That's so cool. Hey, I'm curious too, so you mentioned kind of how Clearway was small enough that I was able to be nimble and kind of adapt to change. Do you have any examples maybe of a time that Clearway did have to kind of adapt to something? I don't know,
yeah.
Kind of putting you on the spot, so if you can't think of anything, it's totally fine.
That's a great question. I mean, I can tell you that there's probably dozens of examples.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, kind of like on the smallest side, things like, you know what, you know, when you do an advertising campaign, you go through formative research,
mm-hmm.
you create concepts, you test those concepts,
mm-hmm.
and then you go with what works best
mm-hmm.
with your target audience. And, you know, there were times where what we thought would land on top did not. And so then it was like, oh, okay, let's readjust.
Absolutely.
Because we needed to stay true to what would work for our target audience, not what I thought would help get people to quit plan or to, you know, believe that secondhand smoke is unhealthy,
mm.
but what our target audience thought would do that. So, you know, in the smallest way, it was like, okay, we took a risk with a couple of those concepts, or we thought they would be a sure thing, but because the research backed that up, but what we found was that, you know, public opinion and sentiment shifts over time. And so sometimes it's shifted. And so then you have to, And you're two steps behind it, so then you have to catch up, right? And you have to develop a different ad. I think one of the other things
mm-hmm.
that comes to mind that I thought was really powerful is we worked with a number of the American Indian Nations,
mm-hmm.
You know, here in Minnesota. And because, you know, the Native community has the highest smoking rate. And, you know, but through historical trauma and cultural trauma and in history, you know, they are really the best place to, you know, determine how will we address this in our community. And we really wanted to support that. But it took a long time to develop trust and relationships,
mm.
and we had some really talented staff that did that work. But there were a couple of things that occurred. You know, in some of our nations here, tobacco is sacred. And it might not be the type, when we think of tobacco, like the tobacco in the cigarette.
Sure.
It's different plants, but nonetheless it's called tobacco, and
mm.
it's sacred. And, so we really needed to and wanted to make a distinction between commercial tobacco
mm-hmm.
and sacred tobacco. And that eventually led itself to a campaign called Tobacco is Sacred
mm-hmm.
that we helped support, that our, you know, Native American partners were part of creating as well. I mean, and I think it was really powerful. We also had research, worked with the community on research, worked with the community on policy change, and they did some really, really great work. And the last report I knew is that the rate had gone down. Still lots of work
yeah.
to do, but that the rate had gone down.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, we did have to adjust some of the ways we did things. Like, just even how we, when you're administering grants, there's lots of rules at the state and federal level about how you have to do that. And so you develop a system to do it. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really fit with their systems and their cultural approach. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we still had to adhere to state and federal laws, all of that. But we, and again, I was supportive of this. You know, I wasn't doing the work directly, mm-hmm. but, our team came up with ways to adjust. And we were able to do that because we just didn't have all this bureaucracy, right? You could just walk down the hall and talk to the CFO and the accounting manager and say, boy, how could we approach this differently? Mm-hmm. You know, and we tried to do the same thing for how we approached working with the nations on potential ads or okay. campaigns or things like that. And again, I don't think we did it perfectly, but I sure think we were committed to trying to be good partners and figure out how we could change and meet, meet them in places where they knew what's best for their community and support that.
Absolutely.
And try to see if we could make progress from there. So that's kind of like a little example and then a little bit bigger example. There were times when, from my colleague Barbara, a research grant just wasn't getting off the ground. Mm-hmm. And we decided, you know what, it takes a lot to roll back a grant, but we're going to. Or there were times where, a research project, we could see after a year, we could see all this other potential in it. And so, let's adjust resources and go down that road. So I think there were just lots of opportunities to refine and hone as we went, and we, tried to take advantage of that as best we could.
Perfect. Oh, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I'm curious too, what other underrepresented communities did you work with, and did you experience kind of similar, not challenges, but did you have to shift your expectations in similar ways?
Well, so we worked with a number, mm-hmm. and we had something called the Leadership Institute mm-hmm. that brought a number of disproportionately affected communities together, to develop leaders around tobacco control within their own communities.
Okay.
So, besides the Native American population having a very high rate, so does the LGBTQ community,
okay.
and African American community. Mm-hmm. There are other, I'm trying to think of who else was, mm-hmm. African immigrants, mm-hmm. The Hmong community mm-hmm. was a part of that. There were other Asian communities a part of it too. The smoking rate's a little lower, but it was very high among men and very low among women.
Oh, interesting.
And there was also just traditions that had come up, like gifting cigarettes at weddings and things like mm-hmm. that. And so there were just some cultural areas as well. So, really any racially diverse population with a higher rate, this leader and LGBTQ, and some people crossed over all those, were in there. But then we also looked at other populations because, like, blue-collar population mm-hmm. has a higher rate. The rural population has a higher rate. Veterans have a higher rate, mm-hmm. And so, we didn't have a leadership institute for all those populations, but that was always front and center in how we designed programs. Low-income folks have a higher rate. Mental health, people with mental health comorbidities have a higher rate.
Okay.
So.
Perfect. Thank you. Let's see, what were some of the major challenges that you observed in Clear Bay over the roughly 15 years that you worked there?
Changes?
Yes.
Okay.
Challenges.
Oh, okay, I just was looking at this. I thought it said what major
changes. Oh, no!
Do you
You're
challenge?
Right.
Okay.
I misread. Changes. Thank you so much.
No, and we can...
Skipping ahead.
I think that's the next one. Yeah.
It is indeed.
No, but we don't have to go in order. Whatever order you want. You know, I can answer the one about changes,
Perfect.
You know, it pretty quickly. I think that change at Clearway came about very intentionally, except for maybe the lawsuit years.
Okay.
Very intentionally. We were very strategic, very focused, very deliberate in our planning. Some might say overly, but who knows? But, you know, I think that there may be three or four things that come to mind. That increasing focus and recognition of our limited time,
okay.
that created more change as we went, you know, down the road. It also created some ambiguity, which some people were uncomfortable with because it was kind of like, well, we're just going to have to see, you know? And, but change and being flexible were the name of the game for sure, as well as being disciplined, though, toward these goals we were trying to achieve. Growth in staff, of course. And I mean growth, like, yeah, sure, numbers, but also in their expertise and professionalism
okay.
and their being seasoned. I mean, just their ability to problem solve, navigate complex legislation. I mean, when we were trying to pass tax, Molly Moylan and, you know, and Amanda became just like experts on tax policy, right? I mean, so, you know, just watching people really grow and change and take hold of things and really become top of field professionals was really rewarding for me, at least.
I imagine that the longevity of people
yeah.
at the organization helps contribute to that as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we were lucky. You know, it was nice to get some national recognition from time to time. That was pretty cool. Certainly that was a change from our early years.
yes.
You know, and probably the big, you know, like, the big change mm-hmm. was that we could see progress. We mm-hmm. could see the rate falling. We were doing, and then in addition to that, we did a legacy study. And so in the end, you know, we contributed to a 40% reduction in smoking in Minnesota. And that means thousands of cancers prevented, hospitalizations prevented from heart disease, diabetes, respiratory disease, and a lot of smoking contributed deaths avoided. So it was like, that's a lot of change, right, if I'm kind of thinking of it in
yes.
that sense, not just in the kind of, you know, the sense of how the organization itself.
Sure.
So, but if you want to talk about challenges, we can talk about that too.
That sounds good. I want to
yeah.
commend you for all of that
yeah.
amazing work. I mean, just seeing those numbers, it's so impressive. And
it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to have been a part of it. You know, I mean, it's like, and it took a village, no question.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was one of many who contributed to that.
Mm.
And I'm just so glad that we, yeah, I mean, coalition-wide, you know, partners statewide, the staff itself. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Wonderful.
But let's talk about challenges. I think that is next on your list, if I'm looking at this list correctly.
Yes.
So the legal and public scrutiny was a huge challenge, obviously. The negative media attention and, you know, that came with that, it was a lot of personal discomfort and stress for board and staff and our partners, for that matter. But we got through that. I will say other challenges, though, that we haven't really touched on too much yet is, like, organized political opposition to us.
Cool.
So the tobacco industry has a lot of paid lobbyists. They also hire, you know, surrogates or proxies to, you know, do other work for them to oppose, you know, to oppose things that will reduce the rate or prevent people from starting. I mean, that's what it comes down to is, you know, they want to prevent anything that will get in the way of making profits. So, you know, they not only lobbied against what we were trying to lobby for, or would introduce new things that would allow them more latitude in, you know, pursuing expanding their business, you know, they challenged us in other ways about our tactics and things like that, too. And then, you know, there certainly is, and I acknowledge this, just some disagreement with people feeling like you shouldn't pass laws to help people quit. You shouldn't pass laws to protect people from secondhand smoke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for some people, it's not it's not that they work for the tobacco industry or feel you know some allegiance there. Mm-hmm. It's that they just simply disagree. They don't think that that is government's role, or they want to enjoy a cigarette where they want to enjoy it, or and it's not even just all smokers by any stretch. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can just have philosophical differences about the role of government. Absolutely. Regulation and things like that, and I can appreciate that, and I think we had some really productive exchanges. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we agreed to disagree, and we were going to try to push our point. I think that those were probably the biggest buckets of challenge that we had.
Okay. And did those disagreements fall along party lines?
Not really. Okay. You know, I think that some people like to paint that Republicans were less inclined, and I think sometimes in the legislature they were. Mm. But I can tell you, because I surveyed people for years, you know, just to gauge public opinion on these topics, at the time that I was doing that kind of survey work and polling people in Minnesota about their opinions or doing focus groups with them on their opinions, there were no differences. In fact, it's one of the few, having worked with people that work on lots of different issues in politics, it's one of those few issues that is truly bipartisan, or at least it was, when I was in the midst of doing that work. You had people that identified as conservative Republicans, sometimes even more in favor of laws that would curtail smoking in public places. So that was kind of interesting. I think that sometimes at the legislature, policymakers themselves, I think, the public was always ahead of the legislature on a lot of this stuff for quite a while. But I think that sometimes Republican legislators thought kind of, boy, can I really support that? Because that's about more government intervention, and I'm about less government intervention. Okay. Or when it came to the tobacco tax that we wanted to pass and eventually did get signed by a Republican governor, a lot of Republicans at that point had signed a no new taxes pledge. So even though this was a tax that had proven to reduce youth smoking and proven to reduce young adult smoking, you could dedicate the money to prevention if you wanted to, you could, and it actually impacted very few people, and it was just a user fee, there were some that just felt they couldn't sign on, but it eventually passed and became a part of that work. But I think that's one of the reasons I enjoyed it. We had early on, several times we had Republicans on our board too, and for them, they had no issues in supporting this work. Sometimes for the fiscal side, like what motivated me. Sometimes we had really early on, there was a county commissioner that, besides having some personal impact in his life, he hated the fact that there was a lot of expense to cleaning up cigarette butts in streets after events.
Okay.
And he thought that shouldn't be the case. We shouldn't be spending our money that way. So, I think people come at it from lots of different angles.
Okay.
Personal stories being probably the most common, having a loved one that, suffered from it.
Mm.
But I think there's a lot of angles, and it, I think, truly was and still is a bipartisan issue. I think at one person I've worked with always, when who's done a lot of work on this at the national level, I think that question of, if you ask anyone, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, when do you want your kids to start smoking? Or when do you want your kids to start vaping? None of them want that. So I think we have a lot of common interests together, right, to work on the issue.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, and then this next question, you've touched on this a little bit already, but curious to hear a little bit more about how you and your team ensured that ClearVape had the greatest possible impact in its limited lifespan.
Yeah, so I think I've touched on this, but we followed proven and best practices.
Perfect.
And the science. That was always a value of the organization. So that meant policy change, social norm change, providing cessation services, mm-hmm. making sure people knew about those cessation services, you know, doing research, things like that. You know, we collectively shared a commitment to the mission and had those really high standards. We were really disciplined about operationalizing the strategic plans the boards passed and checking in with them. These were not documents that sat on a shelf or in a computer file. We had measures and goals, and we tracked them, and we adjusted. We reported if we, you know, if something was lagging, you know, we were transparent, and it was all about operationalizing those plans, or if something wasn't working, getting rid of it so it wasn't dragging down, you know, and using resources. So I think we had a lot of discipline as an organization. And then, as I said, I think the board, the leadership, the staff, collectively, we created an organization that, you know, creativity, problem solving, innovation were all rewarded, and it was okay to make mistakes, you know, and learn from them and move forward.
Interesting. So. Absolutely. Okay. And then, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just trying to remember here. At the end of Clearway's lifespan term, did it have, it had some amount of money that hadn't been used, correct? Or had it all been?
I don't think it was very much.
Okay.
If there was any. This would be a question for David or Molly or, maybe it's even in here.
All right.
This is the last legacy report.
I think David did touch on it, and I don't believe there was a ton of money.
No, I don't think there was. And I, just not having been there at that time, I can't tell you what. I mean, I believe it was to go back to the state.
Okay.
But I don't know, and I don't know if any did, because really the organization can make grants right up until the end.
Sure.
So it very well maybe made a grant with any leftover funds, too. But you would have to check with David on that. I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Oh, you're
that.
Fine. Don't worry about it.
I don't see it here.
Oh, good. Hey.
Yeah, because I left, I don't know, maybe 3 years before the organization closed.
Sorry.
Maybe four, right around there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. My next question, then. Mm-hmm. Could you describe your transition out of Clearway and what work went into that?
Yeah. So I'll talk about this in terms of organizational transition. Mm-hmm. I think I've touched on that, you know, starting, we always were really focused on strategic plans, mm-hmm. but starting in about 2012 or 13, our leadership team really, you know, knew and decided we had to really be focused on our legacy.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about a legacy that makes us look good legacy, mm-hmm. although we would hope that would come from it, right?
Sure.
But I'm talking about, you know, what are our legacy goals? What, how will we know this endeavor will be successful
yes.
at the end? What does that look like? How can we measure it? Then how do we make sure that our resources are and staffing and talent is aligned with that?
Mm-hmm.
So we really spent a lot of time, especially in the last 5-6 years I was there, doing all the good work we normally did, but also constantly looking at that and asking ourselves that and running financial models and
right.
making sure that we could, I think Paul Orman used to say, land the plane on the runway, you know? And so, you know, we asked ourselves lots of, I think, good questions, you know, that how can we have the most impact in the mm-hmm. time we have left? How will we manage transitions and change with staff? How many staff do we need and at what stages do we need them and who? You know, it's not just about number, it's about the talent
Absolutely.
Around the table. What work could we transition to other partners? How could we set Minnesota and other partners up for future success? Mm. And I think that's one of probably, you know, on the short list of really big wins is getting more money for the Department of Health.
Okay.
In that last 5 years we were in existence, so they could do more work. They really weren't getting much from the legislature for many, many years. They got some from the federal government, the CDC, and then just a small amount from the legislature. And so through passage of a couple bills, they now get more. And that's good because they are an organization that should be at the very center of continuing to address tobacco use in Minnesota and vaping and e-cigarettes and all that stuff.
Mm.
So how could we preserve our legacy? What could we leave that so others could learn from this grand experiment that, you know, was set up that was Clearway, Minnesota? Mm-hmm. And then there are just some legal steps to shut down an organization.
Yeah.
And so David really took the lead on that, and I would defer to him on that. But, you know, we really wanted there to be transparency and predictability and an orderliness, mm-hmm. but also a great impact to it all. So for my part, I left a little earlier than my, you know, I guess my time that we all sketched out
sure.
together, and everyone had an end date, you know, because
yeah.
you kind of had to do that.
Exactly.
But, you know, one thing that I think also was a cool thing about Clearway is I talked to you about kind of the talent and the teams and the people, and just having an organization that was all about how can I help you be your very best? Mm-hmm. What are your goals? What are your objectives? You know, is it to run a nonprofit someday? Is it to be our lead lobbyist at some point? Is it, you know, to be a lead researcher? You know, whatever it is. So this staff that, you know, had a lot of longevity, mm-hmm. we had been, I mean, they were becoming more and more seasoned. They were just really good. And they were leaders in, you know, themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they had taken on more and more responsibility. And so at one point, you know, as we're kind of running all these models and as I'm thinking about, you know, kind of my future,
mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, my team is so seasoned and so good. I thought that a couple of them had the talent and the skills to bring a couple things further along than I did. So it was time for me to step out of the way. I also felt like it was my fiscal responsibility.
Okay.
The organization could use the money, right? That they were paying me on other things.
Sure.
You know, when I made that calculation about, well, you know, yes, there are more things I could do. I'm good at this.
Okay.
You know, I can do a lot of things. But have I done about 90% of what I set out to do? Yes. Did I leave them with a great plan that they can adjust from here on out? You know, me and others who worked on that? Yes. Is there really talented staff that can step in and take on that? It's not even the same role. Some of it was the same, but it was also a changing role because we were getting into that last, you know, 3-4 years,
sure.
right? So I just decided, you know, it was time for me to move forward and try my hand at consulting, which is something I had wanted to do for a while. And so I've done that now the last five and a half years, I guess. And I just feel like it was really the right decision at the right time. And part of that was putting things in place a decade prior that I had no idea that would pay off like that. But and then probably 6 years prior, I knew it would pay off. But
okay.
like, you know, I don't know, there's not that many models around limited life organizations. So,
no.
you know, it just provides a whole different mindset. And I will admit I loved it. So,
you're saying it?
Yeah.
And then I guess after you left Clearway, I imagine like emotionally it's hard to kind of separate yourself from that work that you've been mm-hmm. doing for
yeah.
15 years. Like, were you able to kind of keep up with what they were doing?
Yeah.
Monitor that?
Yeah. Yes, on all those counts. On the one hand, it was nice to have some separation.
Makes
but
sense.
I will say, you know, I don't have any clients here in the state, mm-hmm. but maybe about a third of my consulting work is with national people that work on these issues.
Oh, really?
And that has been really fun. And it's been really fun in that I still have the energy and drive to continue to kind of meet those challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have other work, which is good, because it was just time to, you know, have some other work. But I also like to, they are gracious enough to keep me on the list. So if I want to join a coalition call, I just do it as a volunteer. And then I volunteer on one committee as well. And, you know, that ebbs and flows how much I can because of, you know, my time constraints. But it's a great group of people. It's a great community in Minnesota. They're still doing unbelievable work. I mean, sometimes I kind of just sit back in awe and think, huh. Wow, look at that. Look at what they're doing. And so that's been a lot of fun to kind of, you know, have been able to step away, I feel like at the right time, mm-hmm. but to also kind of be in touch with what's happening here, but also use my skills in different capacities, you know, in with different organizations. So.
Absolutely. Pretty cool. All right. I'm curious what work projects, campaigns, etc. you're proudest of from your time at Clearway.
Gosh.
There must be hundreds to choose from.
Well, there are a lot to choose from. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, and I think there's really kind of three things that come to mind, like if I encapsulate it. I mean, one is to just be a part of reducing death and disease, that 40% reduction in tobacco use, or in smoking, I should say, in smoking. Yeah. I mean, that is, it's just like, that's cool, you know? It's like, yay, we got something done. I think the success of Quit Plan Services, of passing the Freedom to Breathe Act, which made workplaces, bars, restaurants smoke-free, tobacco-free, increasing the price of tobacco. And then, you know, the work done with the Native American nations, the American Indian Helpline, the Keeps Tobacco Sacred campaign, those were... Yeah, big things. That was hard work, a long time in the making. I wasn't even on the front end of it, but definitely played a supporting role. And I just think that the work that the nations have done and that we were lucky enough to support is really impressive. And then I think the last thing is I'm just super proud of the team we built and kind of the talent that we harnessed. And I just got to work with, I mean, internally in the organization for sure, also, you know, with partners outside of it. I just feel like this group of really outstanding, hardworking, dedicated people came together at kind of the right time period with the right opportunity, kind of lightning in the bottle, right?
Okay.
I don't even know how that saying goes, but something.
Yes.
And, you know, I am proud of, you know, that we could bring a lot of strategic thinking and discipline to all of those gifts that were given to us to get those things done. We weren't perfect, not by any stretch, but I think we did a lot with what we had, so.
Wonderful. And then looking forward, what work do you think is still left to be done in the field of tobacco control, and who do you envision taking on these challenges in the years ahead?
Well, here in Minnesota, there's still an active coalition, right? Mm-hmm. There was a really, Clearway Minnesota and Blue Cross Blue Shield led that coalition all the years that I worked for Clearway. Mm-hmm. There was a very deliberate handoff, and the American Cancer Society as well. And then there was a very deliberate handoff as we exited. And now there's, you know, some additional co-chairs mm-hmm. there as well. And so I think that the coalition itself, which, you know, they was very thoughtful, you know, partially with kind of Clearway saying, hey, a reminder, we're going to leave, and so let's talk about this.
Yes.
But also just because they're really excellent, talented people that were involved in that coalition and still are, and they're doing great work. And so I fully expect that that work will continue, and it might be different and kind of look a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But I think they're on a really good path, but there are, you know, there are new challenges to take up for sure. You know, while I was at Clearway, I witnessed the rise of e-cigarettes. And when Juul came on the market right around 2017, that was a game changer. I mean, the how quickly youth uptake on that was stunning, because cigarette use was at essentially end game rates for youth. So, you know, And regulation was just so far behind, and still is behind, and still is trying to figure out how to manage that and how to work it. So there's a lot there. There's still a very active opposition, right? I mean, not everyone wants to see tobacco use reduced or nicotine addiction reduced. You know, not even among youth, because that's, you know, where... If people don't get addicted young, they tend not to use. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, the tobacco industry continues to try to evolve and try to become more mainstream and create doubt among the science that public health scientists have created. And I think that's going to continue to be a challenge. And so we'll have to, you know, I think the field as a whole is going to have to rise to, you know, to take that up. And then, you know, I think what was a challenge for us at Clearway remains today and remains on lots of issues, but, and that is that progress is uneven. Mm-hmm. You know, Native Americans still have a higher tobacco use rate, right? LGBTQ still have a higher tobacco use rate. Low-income people, people with mental health issues still do too. So, you know, progress has been made on all fronts, but not always equally and not always, you know, for some of those with higher use rates, we'd love to see it faster. But, you know, so that's going to remain a challenge, you know, as people work on this. And then I think that, you know, what has this huge body of research that worked so well with cigarettes, a lot of that can be applied to e-cigarettes, but we have to keep investigating because maybe not all of it fits, right? And e-cigarettes are different. And so we have to keep, you know, moving forward with scientific discovery and being open to what we learn. So, you know, I think those are some of the challenges ahead. And I think that Minnesota and around the nation, there's a lot of talented people working on it, but it's not easy either. It's not easy. So, but I think that, I think more progress will be made for sure.
I think we said about tobacco, the tobacco industry creating doubt about scientific discoveries. That kind of stood out to me. Do you have any examples of ways in which they have created doubt?
Yeah, you know,
just a scary concept. That
right. So this is something that the tobacco industry. So if we go back to even like the 60s when the Surgeon General came out with the first report, you know, they'll sometimes form institutes, you know, or research organizations that they don't call, you know, by their name. They name it something else, right? You know, like the Foundation for Tobacco and Nicotine Research, or I can't remember what one of those early ones was called, so don't quote me on that, I guess. But and they'll do research, but it's research that puts their products in a better light, or it's and so, you know, one of the most recent examples of this that is the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. This is a foundation that was created solely using Philip Morris money, and they give out grants for research as well as, I would say, public relations and marketing purposes around e-cigarettes and harm reduction. You know, harm reduction is a public health term that's been used a long time. Like, is there a way we can move people off of one product that's super harmful to a lesser, a less harmful product if they can't, you know, get off? And I think the tobacco industry has kind of taken that term and now applied it to e-cigarettes. Like, we could just use it for this. And I think that, although I think we should all remain open to the science of what e-cigarettes have, whether it be harm or whether it be some good in helping people quit, I don't think we should trade the good side potentially of helping people quit for addicting a bunch of teenagers to that product. So, you know, but they have regularly put out research, you know, using grants with different other scientists who are willing to work with them that put e-cigarettes in a very favorable light. And so I think that we just all have to pay attention to funding sources. And the tobacco industry has long been funding research and long trying to cast doubt on research that doesn't reflect well on them and try to do research that supports their ends. Now, if legitimate public health scientists find paths, I think that's a different story.
Sure.
You know, I also think that the e-cigarette industry as a whole has not a plate, you know, hasn't, their product is for recreational commercial use. They have not applied to the FDA to go through clinical trials to test their products as cessation aids. There's already you know, I think it's 7 or 8 or 9 different products the FDA has approved that are proven to help people quit smoking. So those are ones I think people should try first.
Yes.
E-cigarettes are really addictive, yeah. And we still don't understand the full, you know, the full impact of them on people's bodies and health. So I think it's just a cautionary approach would be well served. I think, you know, in many ways that ship has sailed. It's, but I would hope that when policymakers are considering policy or regulation, you know, people are considering the source of a particular study, they'll take a look and consider, you know, who paid for it and what does that look like and how can we best serve the public? How can we best serve youth in you know, assuring people don't get addicted?
It's like deja vu.
Kind of.
Seeing it all right. Happen again. Interesting. I think that's all the questions that I have. Is there anything that we missed in the interview that you want to touch on? Anything you want to expand upon?
I don't think so. I think we've covered the big areas. You know, I probably would just end with, you know, I'm forever grateful to have been a part of it and to be a part of the organization and thankful to the people I got to work with and the partners in other organizations I was able to work with, and all of the board members who served on that board through challenging times and better times and everything in between. It really, it was really something I feel good about having been a part of and really proud to have been a part of it. So thanks for the opportunity to talk to you.
Of course. Thank you.